Before we get into today's episode, I'd like to talk to you about Squadcast. If you've listened to this show for a while, you remember Squadcast. It's one of the best ways to produce a podcast with your friends. However, I'm not really talking about that specifically today. Squadcast is running a December-long scavenger hunt. They're sending hunters all over the internet to complete fun tasks. At the end of the month, they're tallying it all up, and the winners are getting some incredible prizes, such as mics from Samson, audio interfaces from Focusrite, marketing services from Podspike, and much more. The prize package is worth over $5,000. Squadcast is even giving away their audio and video plan for free for a year. Sign up for the hunt at contest.squadcast.fm. Happy hunting! Jolly old Saint Nick, the perpetual image of generosity, joy, and goodwill. Just the mention of his name snaps children into good behavior. The power of his goodness has inspired thousands of tales, plays, poems, and songs throughout the years. He's a very solid character. And every solid character has a solid foil, a villain who stands in their way. Santa happens to have many of these rivals, and one is even based on a real man. My name is Josh, and this is Obscure History. Every compelling character has a good counterpart that perfectly balances out their own traits. In literature, this is called the foil. Sometimes it's a hero-to-villain relationship, like Batman and the Joker. Batman is cool and calculating, carefully assessing a situation before jumping in, while the Joker, on the other hand, is wild and sporadic, doing extremely dangerous things without any consideration of the consequences. Or even Batman and Scarecrow. They both use fear as a tool, Batman for good, Scarecrow for evil. You see, they balance each other out. Foils don't need to be hero-to-villain relationships, though. Think about the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. Donatello is the bookworm that never colors outside the lines, and Michelangelo is the fun-loving party animal. Again, balance between those characters. Or Leonardo, the stalwart leader who never loses his cool, and Raphael, the perpetual hothead who easily gives into his emotions. Again, in all things, balance. It makes characters enjoyable and compelling. Our friend Santa Claus has many, many foils. Krampus, for example, is Santa Claus's companion in some places. While Santa is a round-faced, jovial man bringing gifts to all the good little girls and boys, Krampus is a half-man, half-devil beast who beats unruly children with wooden rods. Unlucky children might meet Frau Perkta. Instead of Krampus, rather than simply beating naughty children with a stick, Frau Perkta would rip out their organs and throw them away. Belsnickel is an angry man clad in furs and tattered clothes who would distribute cakes and candies as well as whippings to children in Central Europe. And there's also the 13 Yule Lads. They torment the children of Iceland by pranking them and slipping rotten tomatoes into their shoes if they're disobedient. And while these characters are frightening, or at least are annoying, especially if you're a disobedient child, they have something in common. They are securely locked in the halls of urban legend. Shadowy figures in a memory of a memory, threats used to elicit compliance. However, there's one anti-Santa character that lives in both the halls of urban legend and the very real streets of our reality. In 1450, in a hotly contested part of Central Europe, a boy was born. Sweet, unassuming, innocent. His name was Hans von Trotha, and he was born to a wealthy and important family. His father Thilo was the Archbishop of Merseburg, in what is currently northwestern Germany. His life was, at first, uneventful from what we can tell. He enjoyed the privilege of his family's wealth, he was educated by private tutors, as was customary, and he eventually joined the family business. He entered into the service of the electors and the Counts Palatine of the Rhine and Heidelberg as a young man in the late 1470s. and he was good at it. He made extensive connections to wealthy and important men. While he was still in his 20s, he was mingling with some of the most powerful people in his region. Hans was so good, in fact, that by 1480, the elector Philip the Sincere gave him the hereditary fiefs of two castles, Bertwartstein, including its belongings, and Grafendon. It is important to notice that Von Trotha was given the hereditary fiefs of these two properties, which essentially made him a feudal lord over that area. This exchange was greater than just simply receiving a castle. Hans von Trotha went from being a mover and a shaker in the minor nobility to owning his own castles and having governance over the people who lived near them, in just one brief moment. Though this was a major promotion, it wasn't unheard of for up-and-coming noblemen. I mean, Hans von Trotha was born into a great family, received a great education, jumped into his political duties as quickly as possible, and impressed the people in the highest positions of power. It's not all that surprising that he advanced quickly and was given governance of his own castle. However, what happened next was anything but expected. Hans von Trotha let Grafendon go to waste as it was severely neglected and uninhabitable when he received it from Philip the Sincere. And, since it was a dud, he had no choice but to make the move across the country and put his full effort and attention on Bertwartstein. Castle Bertwartstein is in the southwestern corner of what is currently Germany. Actually, this particular area has changed identities and ownership many times throughout the years. Bertwartstein was in the region of Alsace-Lorraine, which has been independent, French, and German during its existence, depending on the time. It's a beautiful pastoral region. I'm sure that von Trotha was overjoyed to begin his career as a baron in such an idyllic place. But this optimism would sour, eventually. But before we get into that, we need to pay the bills, so hang tight for 90 seconds, and when we get back, we'll hear a tale of mayhem, catastrophe, and merriment. Hans von Trotha moved into his new castle in the country and set about refurbishing it. Within 4 years, the once modest castle had been transformed into an imposing fortress with thick stone walls towering above the trees in the villages surrounding it. Finally feeling as if he were ready to settle into his lofty estate, von Trotha realized that he needed to reclaim the property from a nearby abbey. Do you remember earlier when I mentioned that he was given Castle Bertwartstein and specifically all of its property? Henry, the abbot of the Order of Benedictine Monks at the Weisenberg Abbey, strongly argued that the property von Trotha was asking for, originally, had been theirs, and had only briefly been placed under the protection of the nobility in 1453, which was around the time von Trotha was born. The men were arguing the validity of a 30-year-old verbal agreement, and they were arguing about it fiercely. Henry the Abbot went above von Trotha to his superiors, expecting them to honor the existing property agreement. He was, however, surprised that rather than force von Trotha to give the property back to the abbey, the sale was forced through in von Trotha's favor. This did not sit well with the abbot. The argument turned into a fight, and the fight turned into a war. Henry the Abbot and his order of monks began accusing von Trotha of consorting with the devil himself, making dark pacts to work fate into his favor and crush his enemies. In response, von Trotha dammed the river that supplied Weisenberg with life-giving water. The villagers panicked. As the threat of a slow, dehydrating death loomed closer each day, von Trotha finally listened to their pleas and destroyed the dam. As he did so, water exploded downhill toward Weisenberg, and it had been pent up for so long that the force of the stream flooded the village and left it economically destitute for years. After this, Emperor Maximilian I attempted to intervene, but he could not get through to von Trotha. He was blinded by rage and revenge. After failing to adhere to the emperor's warning, Pope Alexander VI summoned von Trotha to a private meeting to evaluate his faith and loyalty to the church. Von Trotha refused and instead sent back a scathing letter accusing the Pope and previous popes of immorality and wrongdoing. Von Trotha was excommunicated from the church and banished from the Holy Roman Empire as a result of his actions. In his 40 years on the planet, Hans von Trotha went from being the golden boy, a promising political upstart, the lord of his own castle, to a target of satanic allegation, excommunicated from the church, and banished from his homeland. However, as is typically true of highly motivated people, von Trotha was able to pivot and find success in a different setting. He went to work for the French royal court during the Italian Wars, and his diplomatic skills earned him high regards and awards. He eventually returned to his castle in 1503, and he died there of natural causes. After his death, his excommunication and imperial sanction were removed, posthumously, the following year. Interestingly enough, though, this is not the end of Hans von Trotha's story. It is only the beginning. His long feud with the church had only solidified the rumors of his dealings with dark forces, and though his physical body was dead, his spirit lived on, haunting the memories of those in Weisenberg. As the tales of this dreadful man who lived in an imposing castle on a hill trickled down through the generations, he transformed into pure, horrifying legend. His name was twisted into a vaguely familiar form. Hans von Trotha eventually became Hans Trapp. It was said that in his final years on the planet, Hans Trapp became so reliant on the powers of Satan that he began to abduct children and cannibalize their flesh to appease the Dark Lord. It was said that he would disguise himself as a scarecrow and sit in fields just off the path, waiting for unsuspecting children to walk by. Once they were within reach, he would stab them with a sharp stick and carry them back to his lair where they would be eaten or sacrificed. And though Hans von Trotha died, Hans Trapp continued to hide in that scarecrow suit, just off the road, waiting for innocent children, for generations. Hans von Trotha became such a legendary villain that his infamy placed him in many local legends, particularly this one. Once, a young maiden ventured into the forest of dawn to pick berries. When she was far away from home, a man suddenly burst out of the thicket, probably the robber baron Hans Trapp from Berwartstein Castle. The man clearly intended to rob the virgin of her innocence, so the young maiden gathered up her skirts and took to flight. But the villain came ever closer to her. In her panic, the young lass failed to watch where she was going. All of a sudden, she found herself panting for breath at the edge of the precipice with the houses of the town far below. Without stopping to think, the young maiden fell over the abyss. And now the miracle happened, because her skirts ballooned out and let her float gently down. She survived the leap entirely unhurt, and ever since, at the spot where her foot landed, a spring has flowed. As the story of Hans Trapp was continually retold and eventually evolved, he found himself in familiar company with those like Krampus and the 13 Yule Lads. In that small southwestern region of Germany, Hans Trapp became an anti-Santa. Actually, better yet, the children of this region witnessed Hans Trapp become a companion to Saint Nick. According to this retelling of the legend by Matt Aron, one day a very young shepherd boy came strolling through the field. Taking a sharpened stick, Hans Trapp thrust into the child and killed him, dragging his corpse back to his house where he butchered the children into pieces and roasted him over his fire. Just as he was about to take the first bite of the flesh he had craved so much, it said that God struck him with lightning. Falling down, he hit his head and died. Parents of the northeastern region of France warned their children that every Christmas Hans Trapp's spirit would come back dressed as a scarecrow, with a hood, to enact his revenge by abducting naughty children into the forest where they are never seen again. After God struck down the legendary figure of Hans Trapp, his spirit lived on. accompanying Santa Claus on his annual gift-giving adventure. While old Saint Nick delivers toys to good little girls and boys, Hans Trapp follows closely behind in the shadows, stealing those children who ignored their parents, who disrespected their elders, who didn't pull their own weight, stabbing them with his sharp fingers, hauling them back to his castle, and eating their flesh. As a reminder of the deadly fate that would befall those on Santa's naughty list, the children of this region would recite this poem. "Look, here comes Hans Trapp. He has a nice, pointed hat and a beard white like a horse. He comes from the beautiful starry sky and brings to children a rod, who do not sing and do not pray. Look, Hans Trapp, we are so small and good and obedient at home. You shouldn't come with your stick because we sing and pray too." So maybe this Christmas, all the children of the world should be grateful that it's only Santa who's watching them when they're sleeping and knows when they're awake. Let's all be thankful that it's not Hans Trapp. Thank you so much for listening to this show. I seriously appreciate it so much. If this show is a little bit different, it's just because I'm playing with the format a little bit. I took out music at the end. It didn't seem like it was serving too much of a purpose anymore. I'm also going to try to cut my announcements down just to limit the amount of clutter at the end of the show. My analytics pretty strongly suggest that not many of you actually stick around to the very, very end. In fact, there's a very large dip at the very end of the show when the story part is done. So I'm experimenting with that. I'm going to try to maybe tell some more direct stories. It seems like that's what you guys enjoy. At least that's what the numbers look like. And so I'm going to give it a shot. I'm always up to trying something new. So if it looks a little bit weird, that's what it is. Hopefully you still enjoy it. It's the same storytelling. It's the same me. And I just upgraded my equipment a little bit. I think I'm upgrading the organization a little bit. So taking it a little bit more seriously, hoping to grow in the new year. Also, thank you so much to everybody. I don't know if you saw, if you follow at All the People Pod on Twitter, which is the Twitter handle for this show, or at Obscure History Podcast on Instagram, you'll see that we got placed with an episode on Bellow Collective's 100 Outstanding of 2021, which is honestly like so ridiculous. Thank you to Ariel Nissenblatt of Squadcast for that. I could not be more grateful and appreciative. So I hope that you guys have a very fun holiday season. I'm going to have a couple of more Christmas episodes coming out, and then we're going to be back into regular Obscure History, which is great because it turns out there's a lot more spooky season material than specifically Christmas season material. So wish me luck as I research. I hope that you all have a very nice week, and I'll talk to you later.